Metachorines. A theor of ancient times, exceptionally gifted at plain geometry but usually silent in dialogues, who was buried under volcanic ash in the eruption that destroyed Orithena. According to those traditions that believe in the existence of the old lineage, the founder, though probably unwittingly, of same. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
2 hours later, I was standing alone at the gates of Orithena. The wall was 20 feet high, made of blocks of fine-grained gray-brown stone that were all the same size and shape. As I stood there, sweating in the sun, waiting for an answer to my knock, I had more than enough time to examine these and to conclude that they had been cast in molds, using some process that fused loose volcanic ash into a sort of concrete. Each was about the size of a small wheelbarrow, say the largest that a couple of avout could move around using simple tools. Anyway, the courses were extremely regular, since all of the blocks were clones. Some were slightly browner, some slightly grayer, but on the whole, the wall looked as if it had been snapped together out of a child's building toy kit. The gates themselves were steel plates, which would last a good long while in this climate. After knocking, I stepped well back to get cleared of the stored heat radiating from those panels, which were large enough to admit two of the largest Drummonds abreast. I turned and looked back at the souvenir stand a few hundred feet down the hill. Cord, leaning back against the shady side of Yule's Fetch, waved at me. Saman took a picture on his Jijah. The gate was framed between a pair of cylindrical bastions perforated with small gridded windows. The one on the left sported a tiny door, also of steel. After some time had passed, I ambled over and knocked on it. Framed in its upper half was a hatch, just about the size of my hand. 10 minutes or so later, I heard movement on the other side. A door opened, then slammed shut within the bastion. A latch scrabbled. The little hatch creaked open. The room on the other side of it was dark and, I guessed, delightfully cool. But my eyes were adjusted to the blasting sun of an Ekba noon and I could see nothing. Know that you address a world that is not your own and into which you may not pass save that you make a solemn vow not to leave it again, said a woman's voice, speaking in locally accented Flukish. This was what she was supposed to do. Gatekeepers in places like this have been saying this, or some variant of it, since Cartus. Greetings, Mysore, I said. Let us speak in Orth, if you please. I am Fra Erasmus of the Edharian chapter of the Decenarian Math of the Consent of St. Edhar. A pause. Then the hatch closed and was latched. I waited for a while. Then the hatch opened again, and I heard a deeper, older woman's voice. I am Dimma, she said. Greetings, Sir Dimma. Fra Erasmus at your service. That I am your sir, or you my fra, is very much undecided in my mind, as you come so attired. I have traveled far, I returned. My bolt, cord, and sphere were stolen from me as I made peregrine across the Seculum. No convox is summoned hither. We do not look for peregrines. It seems inhospitable, I said, that Orithena, whence the first peregrines departed, should not open her gates for one who has returned. Our duty is to the discipline, not to any custom of hospitality. There are hotels in town. Hospitality is their business. The little hatch made a noise as if she were getting ready to close it. What part of the discipline permits a vow to sell soap extramuros? I asked. Where does the discipline state that bolted fras may stroll about yonder town? Your discourse belies your claim to be a vow, said Dimma. As a fra would know that there are variations in the discipline from one math to the next. Many avout would not know it, since they never leave their own maths, I demurred. Precisely, Dimma said, and I could imagine her smirking in the dark at how deftly she had turned the point to her advantage, for I was on the outside, where no avout should be. I grant that your customs may differ from those of the rest of the mathic world, I began. She interrupted me. Not so much so that we would admit one who had not sworn the vow. Did Orlo swear the vow, then? A few seconds of silence. Then she closed the hatch. I waited. After a while, I turned back, waved to my friends, and pantomimed a big shrug. It was strangely difficult to reconnect with them, even in such a simple gesture, after having stared over the threshold of the math. I had bid goodbye to them a few minutes ago as if I'd be back in time for lunch, but for all I knew, I might end up spending the rest of my life there. The hatch again.
"State your business, you who style yourself Fra Erasmus," said a man in Orth.
"Fra Jad, millenarian, would know Orlo's mind on certain matters and sends me in quest of him."
"Orlo, who was thrown back?"
"The same."
"One on whom the anathem has been rung down may never more go into a math,"
the man pointed out.
"And for that matter, one who has been evoked and dispatched to Convox at Tredegar may not suddenly present himself at a different math on the other side of the world."
I had already suspected the answer before we reached Ekba. Certain clues had bolstered my hypothesis, but strangely, what clinched it for me was the architecture of the place. No concessions to the mathic style here.
"The riddle that you pose is a trying one," I admitted. "However, on reflection, its answer is clear."
"Oh? What is its answer, then?"
"This is not a math," I said.
"What is it, if not a math?"
"The cloister of a lineage that was born 1,000 years before Cardus and her discipline."
"You are welcome to Orathena, Fra Erasmus."
Heavy bolts moved, and the door swung open. I stepped forward into Orathena and into the lineage. At St. Edhar, Orlo had grown a little doughy, though he kept in decent shape by working in his vineyard and climbing the steps to the Starhenge. At Bly's Butte, according to Estimar's phototypes, he had lost some of that weight and gone shaggy-headed and grown the obligatory feral beard. But when I picked him up at the gates of Orathena and spun him around 5 times, his body felt solid, neither fat nor emaciated. And when I finally let him go, tears were making wet tracks down his tanned and clean-shaven cheeks. That was all I saw before my vision was blurred with tears, and then I had to break away and walk to and fro in the shade of the Great Wall to get my composure back. The discipline had taught me nothing of how to cope with such an event. Throwing my arms around a dead man. Perhaps it meant that I, too, was now dead to the mathic world and had moved on to a sort of afterlife. Cord, Yule, Ganal, and Saman had served as my pallbearers. It took a powerful effort of will to remember that they were still out there, wondering what was going on. There was a little fountain in the cloister. Orlo fetched me a ladle of water. We sat together in the shade of the clock tower as I drank. It tasted of sulfur. Where to begin? Oh, there's so much I would have said to you, Pa, if I could have when you were thrown back. So much I wanted to say to you in the weeks following, but it all flows back.
Beg pardon?
Those things flow back in time, and as they do, they change. Your mind changes them so that they no longer need talking about quite so much.
Fine.
Let's talk of what is fresh and interesting.
All right. You're looking well.
You aren't. Scars honorably earned, I hope?
Not really. Learned a lot, though. But I did not really feel like telling him the story.
We made idle chit-chat for a few minutes until we both realized how ridiculous it was, then got up and began to prowl around. A younger Fra, if that was the correct term for one who lived in a math that was not a math, brought me a bolt, which I traded for my secular clothes. Then Orlo led me away from the cloister along a broad path, beaten down by countless sandaled feet and barrow wheels, to the edge of a pit big enough to swallow the Minster of St. Edhar several times over. If we had built our monument by piling stone on stone, building up from the ground, they had built theirs by digging down, a shovel load at a time. The walls of the hole were too steep, the soil too loose to be stable. They had shored it up by using slabs of fused ash. A ramp spiraled down to the bottom. I started down it, but Orlo held me back.
"You'll notice there are no people down there. It gets hotter as you descend. We dig at night. If you insist on going for a hike, we'll ascend."
And he gestured up the mountainside.
I already knew from Saman's pictures and from yesterday's scouting trip that Orathena had two wall systems, an inner and an outer. They coincided along the road where the main gate stood. The huge 20-foot wall enclosed the cloister where the Avout lived and the hole in the ground where they delved. The outer wall was much lower, perhaps 6 feet high, so more symbolic than anything else. It reached thousands of feet up the mountainside, embracing a strip of ground that ran all the way to the volcano's caldera. It was clear from the pictures that mine works had been created up at the top, possibly to extract energy from the volcano's heat. So there I reckoned it would be hot, foul-smelling, and dangerous. But the territory in between, what Orlo and I walked through, had been transformed into an oasis by the labor of the lineage. Somehow they had found water and used it to raise vines, grain, and all manner of trees that yielded fruits and oils while casting dappled shade on the path up the mountain. The temperature dropped a little, the breeze freshened with every step. The effort of climbing kept me warm, but when we reached a suitable altitude to stop, enjoy the view, and nibble at the fruits we had pilfered along the way, my sweat dried instantly in the cool, dry wind off the sea, and I had to wrap myself up. We passed beyond the upper limit of Orathena's orchards and wandered through a belt of twisted, gnarled trees to a sloping meadow, dusted with what had looked from a distance like frost. But it was actually a carpet of tiny white wildflowers that somehow found a way to grow here. Colorful insects flew around, but there weren't enough of them to be obnoxious. They were kept in check, I guessed, by the birds who sang from perches in scrub trees and bursts of spiky vegetation. We sat on the exposed root of a tree that must have been planted the spring after the volcano had gone off. Orlo explained that these trees, which were no taller than I, were in fact the oldest living things on Arbre. Most of our conversation that afternoon consisted of such tour guide stuff. In a way, it was a great relief to chatter about birds and trees and how many cubic feet of earth had been removed from the dig and how many of the temple buildings had been excavated, rather than talking of such weighty affairs as the geometers, the convocs, and the lineage. Later, we hiked down and supped at the refectory with the 100 or so Fras and Sewers who lived there. Their FAE, Fra Landasher, the third of the three who had interrogated me at the gate, formally bade me welcome and made a toast in my name. I drank more than my share of their wine, which was infinitely better than what Orlo made in his frost-bitten vineyard at St. Edhar, and slept it off in a private cell. I awoke, sour, hungover, out of sorts, thinking it was late and that I'd overslept. But no, it was early, and the night shift of diggers were coming out of their pit with their picks, trowels, brushes, and notebooks, singing hilarious marching songs. They had constructed a bathhouse where hot water was sluiced down from volcanic springs and routed through vertical shafts where you could get blasted clean in about 10 seconds. I stood in one of those until I could no longer breathe, then stepped out and let my new matter bolt pull the water off my skin. This helped a little. But what was really throwing me for a loop was the re-entry shock of being back in the Mathic world, with its view of time so different from what I'd grown used to extramuros. Making it worse was that no one had explained the place's rules to me yet. In most ways, it was like a Cartesian math, but they'd not made me swear a vow, and I got the sense that I could walk out the door whenever I chose. They just pretended it was a math when they were dealing with anyone who might not understand. Being a vout was their cover story. And yet, it was no lie, for they were as dedicated to their work as any who lived in St. Edhar, perhaps more so. In that they wouldn't suffer that work to be impeded by rules, would not submit to the dictates of any inquisition. Fra Landasher intercepted me coming out of the sluice bath and introduced me to Sura Spry, a girl of about my age, or rather reintroduced me, since she was the first person I had spoken with yesterday at the gate. She reminded me disconcertingly of Ayla. It was now or never, explained Landasher, for me to descend and see the ruins. For if we waited any longer, it would be too hot. Sura Spry was to be my guide. She had packed a basket of food that we could nibble on as we went. It was clear from the looks on their faces that they expected I'd be thrilled. And what would be more reasonable?
Yet I had to feign gratitude because what I really wanted was to awaken Orlo and talk to him of pressing secular matters. Not having known what might happen at the gate, I'd made the plan yesterday with Cord, Yule, Ganel, and Saman that if I was allowed to go inside, they should wait for an hour, and then, if nothing happened, come back 3 days later, at which time I'd try to get word out to them as to what ought to be done next. I felt that my 3 days were flying by, and so in truth I did not want to go on a long tourist hike with some girl I had only just met. It was in a peevish mood that I began to descend the ramp, carrying Sewer Spry's picnic basket on one arm. It was in an altogether different mood, though, that I reached the bottom, kicked off my sandals, and felt under my bare feet the paving stones on which Adrakanes had walked. The temple steps where Dyax had brandished his rake. The analemma, where generations of physiologer priests had celebrated Provenor. And the tile-strewn decagon, where Metachorines had stood lost in thought as the whole place was buried under ash. "Did you find him?" I asked Spry.
"Who? Metachorines?"
"Yes."
"Yes. He was the first one my forerunners, looked for. They found, standing upright, a—"
She balked, looking awed and disgusted.
"Skeleton?" "A cast," she said. "A cast of his whole body. You can look at it if you want. Of course, it's just speculation that it is the actual Metachorines, but it fits perfectly with the legend. He even had his head bowed, you know, as if he were looking at the tiles."
The plaza we were standing on, the one where Metachorines had been buried and cast in stone, was the Teglon made real. It was flat, decagonal, maybe 200 feet across, paved in smooth slabs of marble. In ancient times, the plaza had been plentifully supplied with tiles made of clay baked in molds. There were 7 molds, hence 7 different shapes of tiles. Their shapes were such that it was possible to fit them together in an infinite number of patterns. That's not possible with squares or equilateral triangles. Those fit together in repeating patterns, so there are no choices to make. But as long as you had more copies of the Teglon tiles, you could go on making choices forever. Hundreds of tiles were scattered around the place even now, and from place to place, the modern-day Orathenans had been putting them together in little arrangements. I squatted down and looked at one, then looked questioningly at Spry.
"Go ahead," she said. "It's a modern reproduction. We found the original molds."
I picked up a tile for a closer look. This one happened to be 4-sided, a rhombus. A groove was molded into its surface, curving from one of its sides to another. I carried it over to the nearest vertex of the decagon and set it down. Its obtuse angle fit perfectly into the corner.
"Ah," Sewer Spry teased me. "Going straight to the most difficult problem of all, huh?"
She was talking, of course, of the Teglon. She turned away and walked to the opposite vertex and set a tile down there. Meanwhile, I scavenged a few other tiles, getting samples of all 7 shapes. I chose one at random and set it next to the first. This one also had a groove curving from one side to another. All of the tiles were so made, and I rotated it until its groove mated with and became a continuation of the one on the first tile. Into the angle between them, I was able to place a third. That created opportunities to slide in a 4th, a 5th, and so on. I was playing the Teglon. The objective of the game was to build the pattern outwards from one vertex and pave the entire decagon in such a way that the groove formed a continuous unbroken curve from the first vertex to the last, the one directly opposite, where Sewer Spry had put down a tile. Along the way, the curve had to pass across every tile in the entire decagon. For the first little while, it was easy. It came naturally. But beyond a certain point, the 2 objectives, that of tiling the whole surface and that of keeping the curve going, began to conflict. I had to leave a stretch of groove hanging unconnected for a while, then work my way back to it, steering the groove around to make the connection. That was satisfying. But a few minutes later, I found myself with 3 such segments of marooned groove in different parts of the pattern,
and despaired of ever finding an arrangement that would connect them all. On one level, this was all about the shape of the outer boundary and how it developed. Tiles trapped in the middle were of no further interest to the game, or so you might think. But on the other hand, the way in which an interior tile had been laid down ended up determining the location of every other tile in the whole decagon. The ancient Orathenans suspected but didn't know how to prove that the tiles of the Teglon were a periodic, that no pattern would ever repeat. Again, solving the Teglon would have been easy. It would have been automatic, with square or triangular tiles, or any tile system that was periodic. With aperiodic tiles, it was impossible, or at least very unlikely, unless you had some godlike ability to see the whole pattern in your head at once. Metachorines had believed that the final pattern existed in the Hylaean theoric world, and that the Teglon could only be solved by one who had developed the power of seeing into it. Sewer Spry was clearing her throat. I looked up. I was squatting at the edge of a system of tiles 50 feet wide. It was getting hot. "Oh, sorry," I said. "Some people use sticks to push them around. Saves wear and tear on the back." "We should probably get out of here, huh?"
"Soon," she allowed.
First, though, I followed her about as she showed me the remnants of the ancient buildings. All the roofs were gone, of course. Some pillars still stood, and a few courses of stone that had once been walls, now half buried in blocks that had tumbled down from above. But mostly we were looking at foundations, floors, stairs, and plazas. Active parts of the dig were gridded with string, a geometric touch a Draconis would have appreciated. The rocks were annotated with neatly brushed letters and numbers put down by diggers of centuries past. Up above, I knew, was a sort of museum where they had placed many of the artifacts they had found, including, presumably, the cast of Metachorines. I imagined that museum should be dark, nicely ventilated, and cool.
"Okay, let's get out of this barbecue pit," I proposed, and heard no argument from Sewer Spry.
We had stayed later than expected, partly because it had been fascinating, but, and this probably didn't say much for my character, because this was the one thing I could do on this journey that would seem almost as cool as Jessery's space adventure. The climb out was worse than I expected. During the early part of it, I was babbling about the Teglon just like all of those geometers of yore who'd gone crazy over it. But by the end, I was just trudging. Another sluice bath was called for. I fell asleep. When I woke up, it was late afternoon. Orlo was on kitchen duty. I helped him. But we didn't really get to talk about anything. So more than one of my 3 days had been gobbled up just like that. Before we retired that evening, I warned Orlo we must speak of important things the next day. So after breakfast, the next morning, we hiked back up to the meadow.
Skonik, one of a group of Praxic-age Theors who gathered at the house of Lady Barito. They addressed the ramifications of the apparent fact that we do not perceive the physical universe directly, but only through the intermediation of our sensory organs. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
"After I landed at Bly's Butte," Orlo said, "I was like one of those poor cosmographers just after the reconstitution who couldn't use his atom smasher anymore."
"Yes, I saw that telescope," I told him. "The pictures you tried to take of the icosahedron."
He was shaking his head. "Oh, I could not see a thing with that. So my work concerning the aliens had to be based on what I could observe." This didn't make sense to me.
"All right," I said. "What was that?" He looked at me, mildly startled, as if it ought to have been obvious.
"Myself." I was nonplussed, which only showed that I was dealing with the same old Orlo.
"How would self-observation help you understand the geometers?"
"Well, the Skonics are not a bad place to start. Remember Fly, Bat, Worm?"
I laughed. "Just got a refresher on that a couple of weeks ago. Archibald was explaining it to an extra who wanted to know why we didn't believe in God."
"Ah, but that's not what Fly, Bat, Worm says," said Orlo. It says only that pure thought alone doesn't enable us to draw any conclusions one way or another about things that are non-spatial-temporal, such as God.
True.
The same observations that the Skonics made about themselves must also be true of aliens' brains. No matter how different they might be from us in other respects, they must integrate sensory givens into a coherent model of what is around them, a model that must be hung on a spatial-temporal frame. And that, in a nutshell, is how they come to share our ideas about geometry.
But they share more than that, I pointed out. They appear to share the idea of truth and of proof.
It is a reasonable enough supposition,
Orlo said with a cautious shrug.
More than that, I protested.
They emblazoned the Adraconic theorem on their ship.
This was news to him.
Oh, really? How cheeky.
Didn't you see it?
I remind you that I was thrown back before I saw the last picture that I took of the alien ship.
Of course, but I assumed you had taken other pictures before then, had been taking them for a long time.
Streaks and blobs, Orlo scoffed. I was only learning how to capture a decent image of the thing.
So you never saw the geometric proof, or the letters, or the four planets?
That's correct, Orlo said.
Well, there's much more that you have to know if you want to think about the geometers, all kinds of new givens.
I can see how excited you are about those new givens, Erasmus, and I wish you all the best in your study of them, but I am afraid that for me it would all prove a distraction from the main line of the inquiry.
The main line? I don't know what you mean.
Evanadrician datonomy,
Orlo said,
as if this ought to have been quite obvious.
Datonomy, I translated. That would be study or identification of what is given?
Yes. Givens in the sense of the basic thoughts and impressions that our minds have to work with. Saint Evanedric pursued it late in his life after he got locked out of his atom smasher. His immediate forerunner, of course, was Saint Helicarn. Helicarn thought that Skonic thought was badly in need of an overhaul to bring it in line with all that had been discovered since the time of Barito, about theorics and its marvelous applicability to the physical world.
Well, how did he make out?
Orlo grimaced.
Many of the records were vaporized, but we think he was too busy demolishing Proke and kicking away all the ankle-biters Proke sent after him. The work fell to Evanedric.
Has it been an important thing to the lineage?
Orlo gave me a queer look.
Not really. Oh, it's important in principle, but notoriously unsatisfying to work on. Except when great alien ships appear in orbit around one's planet.
So then, are you finding it satisfying now?
Let's be quite direct and say what we mean, Orlo said.
You fear that I'm navel-gazing.
That on Bly's Butte I pursued this line of inquiry not because it was really worthwhile, but simply because I didn't have hard givens about the geometers, and that now that we have evidence that they are, or were, physically and mentally similar to us, this line of inquiry should be dropped.
Yes, I said. That's what I think.
I happen to disagree, Orlo said. But things have changed between us. We are no longer Pa and Fid, but Fra and Fra, and Fras disagree cordially all the time.
Thank you. But it has certainly felt like a Pa-Fid conversation to this point.
Largely because I have a bit of a head start on you.
I let this polite nothing pass without comment. Listen, if I can tear you away from Evanadrician datonomy, we have to talk about secular stuff for a minute.
By all means,
Orlo said. Several of us were evoked to a convox at Tredegar, I said. For unbelievably, Orlo had not yet expressed any curiosity as to why or how I had turned up at Orathena. One of the others was Fra Jad, a thousander. He accompanied me and Arcibald and Leo to Bly's Butte.
And he saw the leaves on the wall of my cell there.
Jad, figured out quickly, weirdly quickly, that you had gone to Ekba and, I guess, that you had ideas about the geometers that he wanted to know more of.
It was neither quick nor weird, Orlo said. All of these matters are connected. It would have been obvious to Fra Jad as soon as he walked in.
How? Do you guys communicate? Violate the discipline?
What do you mean, you guys?
You are carrying around some melodramatic idea of the lineage, aren't you?
Orlo said.
Well, just look at this place, I protested. What is going on?
If I got interested in meteorology, Orlo said, I'd spend a lot of time observing the weather. I would come to have much in common with other weather watchers whom I'd never met. We would think similar thoughts as a natural result of observing the same phenomena. 9/10 of what you think of as mysterious lineage machinations is explained by this.
Except that instead of watching the weather, you're thinking about evanadrician datonomy?
Close enough.
But there was nothing about evanedric or datonomy on the wall of yourself for Fra Jad to see. Just material pertaining to Orathena and a chart of the lineage.
What you identified as a chart of the lineage was really a sort of family tree of those who have tried to make sense of the Hylian theoric world. And it turns out that if you trace the branches of that tree and, so to speak, prune off all the branches populated by fanatics, enthusiasts, deolaters, and dead-enders, you end up with something that doesn't look so much like a tree anymore. It looks like a dowel. It starts with Canoas and runs through Metachorines and Protus and some others, and about halfway along you encounter Evanedric.
So Fra Jad, looking at your tree pruned down to a dowel, would guess immediately that you must be working on Evanedrician datonomy.
And would assume I was doing so in hopes of gaining upsight as to how the geometer's minds must be organized.
What about Ekba? How'd he guess you went to Ekba?
This math was founded by people who lived in the same cells where Fra Jad has spent his whole life. He would know, or surmise, that if I could get to this place, they would let me in the gates and provide me with food and shelter. Quite obviously, a better existence than what I could manage at Bly's Butte.
Okay.
I was feeling relieved of a burden I'd been carrying since that day above Sambal.
So there's not a conspiracy. The lineage doesn't communicate through coded messages.
We communicate all the time, Orlo said, in the way I mentioned.
Meteorologists watching the same cloud.
That's good enough for this stage of our conversation, Orlo said. But you haven't yet unburdened yourself of whatever terribly important-seeming message or mission you brought in the gates with you. What errand has Fra Jad sent you on?
He said, go north until you understand.
And I guess that part of the mission is accomplished now.
Oh, really?
I'm pleased that you understand. I'm afraid I am still full of questions about these matters.
You know what I mean, I snapped. He also implied I was to come back to Tredegar later, that he'd see to it I didn't get in trouble. I guess he wanted me to fetch you, to bring you back to the Convox.
In case I'd developed any ideas concerning the geometers, that might be useful,
Orlo hazarded. Wow, that's the point of a Convox, I reminded him. To be useful.
Orlo shrugged. I'm afraid I don't have enough givens to work with concerning the geometers.
I'm sure that all the givens that are there to be had are available at Tredegar.
They are probably collecting exactly the wrong sort of information, he said.
So go there and tell them what to collect. Fra Jad could use your help.
For me and Fra Jad and some others of like mind, to try to change the behavior of this secular mathic monstrosity called a Convox sounds like politics, which I am infamously bad at.
Then let me try to help, I said. Tell me what you've been doing. I'll go back to the Convox and look for ways to use it. The most charitable way to interpret the look Orlo now gave me was affectionate but concerned. He waited for my brain to catch up with my mouth.
Okay, I said. With a little help from some of the others, maybe. I was thinking of the conversation I'd had with Tullia before Eliger. I can't advise you on what to do at the Convox, he finally said. However, I am happy to explain what I've been up to.
Okay, I'll settle for that.
It won't help you. In fact, it'll probably hurt you at the Convox, because it will sound crazy.
Fine, I'm used to people thinking that we are crazy because of the whole HTW thing.
Orlo raised an eyebrow. You know, on balance, I think that what I'm about to discuss with you is less crazy than that. But the HTW, he nodded in the direction of the Orathena dig, is a cozy and familiar form of craziness. He paused for a few moments, returning his gaze to me.
"Who are you talking to?" Orlo asked.
I was wrong-footed by this bizarre question and took a moment to be certain I'd heard the question right. "I'm talking to Orlo," I said.
"What is this Orlo? If a geometer landed here and engaged you in conversation, how would you characterize Orlo to it?"
"As the man, the very complicated, bipedal, slightly hot, animated entity, standing right over there."
"But depending on how a geometer sees things, it might respond, 'I see nothing there but vacuum with a sparse dusting of probability waves.'"
"Well, vacuum with a sparse dusting of probability waves is an accurate description of just about everything in the universe," I pointed out. "So if the geometer was not able to recognize objects any more effectively than that, he could scarcely be considered a conscious being. After all, if it's having a conversation with me, it must recognize me as..."
"Not so fast," Orlo said. "Let's say you are talking to the geometer by typing into a Gija or something. It knows you only as a stream of digits. Now you have to use those digits to supply a description of Orlo, or of yourself, that it would recognize."
"Okay. I'd agree with the geometer on some way to describe space. Then I'd say, 'Consider the volume of space 5 feet in front of my position, about 6 feet high, 2 wide, and 2 deep. The probability waves that we call matter are somewhat denser inside of that box than they are outside of it, and so on.'"
"Denser because there's a lot of meat in that box," Orlo said, slapping his abdomen. "But outside of it, only air."
"Yes, I should think any conscious entity should be able to recognize the meat-air boundary. What's on the inside of the boundary is Orlo."
"Funny that you have such firm opinions on what conscious beings ought to be able to do," Orlo warned me.
"Well, let me see. What about this?" He held up a fold of his bolt.
"Just as I can describe the meat-air boundary, I can describe how bolt stuff differs from both meat and air, and explain that Orlo is wrapped in bolt stuff."
"There you go, making assumptions," Orlo chided me.
"Such as?" "Well, let's say that the geometer you're talking to has been inculcated in his civilization's equivalent of the Skonix. He'll say, 'Wait a minute, you can't really know. You're not allowed to make statements about things in themselves, only about your perceptions.'"
"True.
So you need to rephrase your statement in terms of the givens that are actually available to you."
"All right," I said. "Instead of saying Orlo is wrapped in bolt stuff, I'll say, 'When I gaze at Orlo from where I'm standing, I see mostly bolt with bits of Orlo, his head and his hands, peeking out. But I don't see why it matters.'"
"It matters because the geometer can't stand where you are standing. It has to stand somewhere else and see me from a different angle."
"Yes, but the bolt wraps all the way around your body."
"How do you know I'm not naked and back?"
"Because I've seen lots of bolts and I know how they work."
"But if you were a geometer, seeing one for the first time,
I'd still be able to surmise that you were not naked and back, because if you were, the bolt would hang differently."
"What if I got rid of the bolt and stood here naked?"
"What if you did?"
"How would you describe me to the geometer then? What would meet your eye and the geometer's?"
"I would say to the geometer, 'From where I stand, all I see is Orlo skin. From where you stand, O geometer, the same is likely true.'"
"And why is it likely?"
"Because without skin, your blood and guts would fall out. Since I can't see a puddle of blood and guts behind you, I can infer that your skin must be in place.
Just as you infer that my bolt must continue all the way round me and back, from the way in which its visible part hangs."
"Yes, I guess it's the same general principle."
"Well, it seems that this process you call consciousness is somewhat more complex than you perhaps gave it credit for at first," Orlo said. "One must be able to take in givens from sparse dustings of probability waves in a vacuum,
i.e. see stuff."
"Yes, and perform the trick of integrating those givens into seemingly persistent objects that can be held in consciousness. But that's not all. You perceive only one side of me, but you were all the time drawing inferences about my other side, that my bolt continues round and back, that I have skin,
inferences that reflect an innate understanding of theoretical laws. You can't seem to make these inferences without performing little thought experiments in your head. If the bolt didn't continue round and back, it would hang differently. If Orlo had no skin, his guts would fall out. In each of those cases, you are using your understanding of the laws of dynamics to explore a little counterfactual universe inside of your head, a universe where the bolt or the skin isn't there. And you are then running that universe in fast forward, like a spiele, to see what would happen. And that is not the only such activity that is going on in your mind when you describe me to the geometers, Orla went on, after a pause to swallow some water, because you are forever making allowances for the fact that you and the geometer are in different places, seeing me from different points of view, taking in different givens. From where you're standing, you might be able to see the freckle on the left side of my nose. But you have the wit to understand that the geometer can't see that freckle because of where it is standing. This is another way in which your consciousness is forever building counterfactual universes. If I were standing where the geometer is, my view of the freckle would be blocked. Your ability to have empathy with the geometer, to imagine what it would be like to be someone else, isn't a mere courtesy. It is an innate process of consciousness. Wait a second, I said. You're saying I can't predict the geometer's inability to see the freckle without erecting a replica of the whole universe in my imagination? Not exactly a replica, Orlo said. Almost a replica, in which everything is the same except for where you are standing. It seems to me that there are much simpler ways of getting that result. Perhaps I have a memory of what you look like when viewed from that side. I call up that image in my memory and say to myself, no freckle. It is a perfectly reasonable thought, Orlo said, but I must warn you that it does not really buy you much, if what you seek is a simple and easy-to-understand model of how the mind works.
Why not? I'm only talking about memory.
Orlo chortled, then composed himself and made an effort to be tactful. Thus far, we have spoken only of the present. We've talked only of space, not of time. Now you would like to bring memories into the discussion. You are proposing to pull up memories of how you perceived Orlo's nose from a different angle at a different time. I sat on his right last night at supper and couldn't see the freckle.
It seems simple enough, I said.
You might ask yourself, what in your brain enables you to do such things?
What things?
Take in some givens one evening at supper. Take in another set of givens now, or 1 second ago, 2 seconds ago, but always now, and say that all of them are, the same chap Orlo.
I don't see what the big deal is, I said. It's just pattern recognition. Syntactic devices can do it.
Can they? Give me an example.
Well, I guess a simple example would be... I looked around and happened to notice the contrail of an aircraft high overhead.
Radar tracking aircraft in a crowded sky. Tell me how it works.
The antenna spins around. It sends out pulses. Echoes come back to it. From the time lag of the echo, it can calculate the bogey's distance. And it knows in what direction the bogey lies. That's dead easy. It's just the same direction as the antenna is pointing when the echo hits it.
It can only look in one direction at a time, Orlo said.
Yeah, it's got extreme tunnel vision and compensates for that by spinning around.
A little bit like us, Orlo said.
We had begun descending the mountain and were walking side by side.
Orlo went on. I can't see in all directions at once, but I glance to the side every so often to make sure you're still there.
Yeah, I guess so, I said. You have in your head a model of your surroundings that includes me off to your right side. You can maintain it for a while by holding down the fast-forward button. But every so often, you have to update it with new givens, or it'll get out of whack with what is really going on.
How does the radar system manage it?
Well, the antenna rotates once and takes in echoes from everything that's in the sky. It plots their positions. Then it rotates again and collects a new set of echoes. The new set is similar to the first one, but all of the bogeys are now in slightly different positions because all of the aircraft are moving, each at its own speed, each in its own direction.
And I can see how a human observer, watching the bogeys plotted on a screen, would be able to assemble a mental model of where the aircraft were and
how they were moving, Orlo said. In the same way as we stitch together frames of a spiele to form a continuous story in our minds. But how does the syntactic device inside the radar system do it? It is nothing more than a list of numbers, updated from time to time. If there were only one bogey, it would be easy, I said. Agreed. Or just a few, widely separated, moving slowly so that their paths didn't cross. Also agreed. But what of the hard case of many fast bogeys, close together, paths crossing? A human observer could manage it easily, just like watching a spiele, I said. A syndev would have to do some of what a human brain does. And what is that, exactly? We have a sense for what is plausible. Let's say there are two aircraft, full of passengers, going just under the speed of sound, and that during the interval between two radar sweeps, their paths cross at right angles. The machine can't tell the bogeys apart. So there are a few possible interpretations of the givens. One is that both planes executed sharp right-angle turns at the same moment and veered off in new directions. Another is that they bounced off each other like rubber balls. The third interpretation is that the planes are at different altitudes, so they didn't collide, and both simply kept flying in a straight line. That interpretation is the simplest, and the only one consistent with the laws of dynamics. So the syndev must be programmed to evaluate the different interpretations of the givens and choose the one that is most plausible. So we have taught this device a little of what we know of the action principles that govern the movement of our cosmos through hemmed space, and commanded it to filter out possibilities that diverge from a plausible world track, Orlo said. In a very crude way, I suppose. It doesn't really know how to apply action principles in hemmed space and all that. Do we? Some of us do. Theors, yes. But a slime playing catch knows what the ball will do, more importantly, what it can't do, without knowing the first thing about theorics. Of course, even animals can do that. Orlo, where is Evan Nedershin Datonomy getting us? I see some connection to our pink dragon dialogue back home a few months ago, but... Orlo got a funny look on his face. He'd forgotten. Oh, yes, about you and your worrying. Yes. That's something animals can't do, he pointed out. They react to immediate concrete threats, but they don't worry about abstract threats years in the future. It takes the mind of an Erasmus to do that. I laughed. I haven't been doing it so much lately. Good. He reached out and gave me an affectionate thud on the shoulder. Maybe it's the all's well. No, it's that you have real things to worry about now. But please remind me how it went, the dialogue about the pink nerve gas farting dragon. We developed a theory that our minds were capable of envisioning possible futures as tracks through configuration space, and then rejecting ones that didn't follow our realistic action principle. Jezri complained it was a heavyweight solution to a lightweight problem. I agreed. Arcibald objected. This was after Fra Paphlagon had been evoked, wasn't it?
Yes.
Arcibald had been reading Paphlagon.
Yes.
So tell me, Fra Erasmus, are you still with Jezri or with Arcibald?
I still think it seems fanciful to think we are all the time erecting and tearing down counterfactual universes in our minds.
I've become so used to it that it seems fanciful to think otherwise, Orlo said. But perhaps we can go on another hike tomorrow and discuss it further.
We were reaching the outskirts of the math.
I'd like that, I said.
As we drew near enough to smell supper cooking, I recollected that I needed to get a message out to my friends the next day. But it was not the right moment to bring this up, and so I resolved to take it up with Orlo the next morning. I had it in my mind that this would force Orlo to make a decision, but as soon as I explained it to him, he made a point that was embarrassingly obvious, once he had made it. The 3-day deadline was perfectly arbitrary, and hence the only sound approach was to brush it aside without any further mention. He called in Fra Landasher, who proposed that my friends be invited into the math and allowed to lodge here for as long as it might take to sort things out. This was shocking until I reminded myself that things were done differently here and that Landasher was beholden to no one except, possibly, the Dalmant that owned Ekba. Then I felt sure that my four friends would have no interest in biding in such a place as this. But a couple of hours later, when I walked out of the gate and down to the souvenir shop to explain matters to them, they accepted unanimously and without discussion. That in itself made me a little nervous, so I accompanied them back to the cove and helped them strike camp, using the afternoon to provide them with a running lecture on Mathic etiquette. I was especially worried that Ganeliel Crade would preach to them. But soon, beginning with Yule and spreading quickly to the others, they began to make fun of me for being so worried about this, and I realized that I had offended them. So I said nothing more until we got back to Orathena. Cord, Yule, Ganel, and Saman were led in through the gate and given rooms in a sort of guest lodge, set apart from the cloister, where they were allowed to keep Jijas and other secular goods. Dressed in their extramuros garb, but without the Jijas, they joined us at dinner and were formally toasted and welcomed by Fra Landasher. The next morning I rousted them early and led them down to the dig for a tour. Ganel looked as if he were having some sort of diolatrous epiphany, though in all fairness, I'd probably had a similar look on my face when Sewer Spry had taken me down there. I asked Saman if he had learned anything more about who was running Ekba, and he said, "Yes, and it's boring." Some burgher, just after the third sack, had become an enthusiast for all things Orathenan. He was very rich, and so he had bought the island, and to run it, set up the foundation, complete with tedious bylaws that ran to 1,000 pages. It was meant to last forever, and so the bylaws had to cover every eventuality they could think of. Executive power lay in the hands of a mixed secular Mathic board of governors, Saman explained, warming to the task, even as my attention was beginning to wander. So getting my friends squared away at Orathena distracted me for a couple of days. After that, I resumed my walks up the mountain with Orlo.
Dialogue. A discourse, usually in formal style, between Theors. To be in dialogue is to participate in such a discussion extemporaneously. The term may also apply to a written record of a historical dialogue. Such documents are the cornerstone of the Mathic literary tradition and are studied, reenacted, and memorized by FIDs. In the classic format, a dialogue involves two principals and some number of onlookers who participate sporadically. Another common format is the triangular, featuring a savant, an ordinary person who seeks knowledge, and an imbecile. There are countless other classifications, including the Suvinian, the Periclinian, and the Peregrine. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
I know that our last conversation was not completely satisfactory to you, Erasmus. I apologize for that. These ideas are unfinished. I am tormented or tantalized by the sense that I'm almost in view of something that is at the limit of my comprehension. I dream of being in the sea, treading water, trying to see a beacon on shore, but the view is blocked by the crests of the waves. Sometimes, when conditions are perfect, I can pop up high enough to glimpse it. But then, before I can form any firm impression of what it is I'm seeing, I sink back down of my own weight and get slapped in the face by another wave. I feel that way all the time, when I am trying to understand something new, I said. Then one day, all of a sudden... You just get it, Orlo said.
Yeah, the idea is just there, fully formed.
Many have noted this, of course. I believe it is related, in a deep way, to the sort of mental process I was speaking of the other day. The brain takes advantage of quantum effects. I'm sure of it. I know just enough about it to know that what you just said has been controversial for a long, long time. This affected him not at all. But after I looked in his eye long enough, he finally gave a shrug. So be it. Did Saman ever talk to you of Sant-Grode's machines?
No. What is it?
A syntactic device that made use of quantum theorics. Before the second sack, his forerunners and ours worked together on such things. Sant-Grode's machines were extremely good at solving problems that involved sifting through many possible solutions at the same time. For example, the lazy peregrine.
That's the one where a wandering Fra needs to visit several maths scattered randomly around a map?
Yes, and the problem is to find the shortest route that will take him to all of the destinations.
I kind of see what you mean, I said. One could draw up an exhaustive list of every possible route.
But it takes forever to do it that way, Orlo said. In a Saint-Grode's machine, you could erect a sort of generalized model of the scenario and configure the machine so that it would, in effect, examine all possible routes at the same time.
So, this kind of machine, instead of existing in one fixed, knowable state at any given time, would be in a superposition of many quantum states?
Yes, it's just like an elementary particle that might have spin up or spin down. It is in both states at the same time.
Until someone observes it, I said, and the wave function collapses to one state or the other. So, I guess with a Saint-Grode's machine, one eventually makes some observation,
and the machine's wave function collapses to one particular state, which is the answer. The output, I believe the Eta call it,
Orlo said, smiling a little as he pronounced the unfamiliar bit of jargon. I agree that thinking often feels that way, I said. You have a jumble of vague notions in your mind. Suddenly, bang, it all collapses into one clear answer that you know is right. But every time something happens suddenly, you can't simply chalk it up to quantum effects.
I know, Orlo said. Do you see where I'm going, though, when I speak of counterfactual cosmi?
I didn't really get it until you brought quantum theorics into the picture, I said. But it's been obvious for a while that you have been developing a theory about how consciousness works. You have mentioned some different phenomena that any introspective person would recognize. I won't bother to go back and list them all. And you have tried to unify them.
My grand unification theory of consciousness, Orlo joked.
Yes, you are saying that they are all rooted in a special ability that the brain has to erect models of counterfactual cosmi in the brain and to play them forward in time, evaluate their plausibility and so on. Which is utterly insane if you take the brain to be a normal syndev.
Agreed, Orlo said. It would require an immense amount of processing power just to erect the models, to say nothing of running them forward. Nature would have found some more efficient way to get the job done.
But when you play the quantum card, I said, it changes the game entirely. Now all you need is to have one generalized model of the cosmos, like the generalized map that a Saint-Grode's machine uses to solve the lazy peregrine problem, permanently loaded up in your brain. That model can then exist in a vast number of possible states, and you can ask all sorts of questions of it.
I'm glad that you now understand this in the same way that I do,
Orlo said.
I do have one quibble, however.
Oh, boy, I said. Here goes.
Traditions die hard among the avowed, Orlo said. And for a very long time it has been traditional to teach quantum theorics to FIDs in a particular way that is based on how it was construed by the Theors who discovered it, way back in the time of the Harbingers. And that, Erasmus, is how you were taught as well. Even if I had never met you before today, I would know this from the language that you use to talk about these things. It exists in a superposition of states. Observing it collapses the wave function, and so on.
Yes, I know where you are going with this, I said. There are whole orders of Theors, have been for thousands of years, that use completely different models and terminology.
Yes, Orlo said. And can you guess which model, which terminology I am partial to?
The more polycosmic, the better, I assume.
Of course. So whenever I hear you talking of quantum phenomena using the old terminology...
The FID version?
Yes. I must mentally translate what you're saying into polycosmic terms. For example, the simple case of a particle that is either spin up or spin down.
You would say that... At the moment when the spin is observed, the moment when its spin has an effect on the rest of the cosmos bifurcates into two complete, separate, causally independent cosmi that then go their separate ways.
You've almost got it. But it's better to say that those two cosmi exist before the measurement is made, and that they interfere with each other. There is a little bit of crosstalk between them until the observation is made. And then they go their separate ways.
And here, I said, we could talk about how crazy this sounds to many people.
Orlo shrugged.
Yet it is a model that a great many Theors come to believe in, sooner or later, because the alternatives turn out to be even crazier in the end.
All right. So, I think I know what comes next. You want me to restate your theory of what the brain does in terms of the polycosmic interpretation of quantum theorics.
If you would so indulge me,
Orlo said, with a suggestion of a bow.
Okay, here goes, I said. The premise here is that the brain is loaded up with a pretty accurate model of the cosmos that it lives in.
At least the local part of it, Orlo said. It doesn't have a good model of other galaxies, for example.
Right. And to state it in the terminology of the old interpretation that FIDs are taught, the state of that model is a superposition of many possible present and future states of the cosmos, or at least of the model.
He held up a finger.
Not of the cosmos, but of hypothetical alternate cosmi differing slightly from the cosmos.
Very good. Now, this generalized cosmos model that each person carries around in his or her brain, do you have any idea how it would work, what it would look like?
Not in the slightest, I said. I don't know the first thing about the nerve cells and so on. How could they be rigged together to create such a model? How the model could be reconfigured from moment to moment to represent hypothetical scenarios?
Fair enough, Orlo said, holding up his hands to placate me. Let's leave nerve cells out of the discussion, then. The important thing about the model, though, is what?
That it can exist in many states at once, and that its wave function collapses from time to time to give a useful result.
Yes. Now, in the polycosmic interpretation of how quantum theorics works, what does all of this look like?
There is no longer superposition, no wave function collapse, just a lot of different copies of me, of my brain, each really existing in a different parallel cosmos. The cosmos model residing in each of those parallel brains is really, definitely, in one state or another, and they interfere with one another. He let me stew on that for a few moments, and then it came to me. Just like those ideas had, spoken of earlier, suddenly there in my head. You don't even need the model anymore, do you?
Orlo just nodded, smiled, egged me on with little beckoning gestures.
I went on, seeing it as I was saying it. It is so much simpler this way. My brain doesn't have to support this hugely detailed, accurate, configurable, quantum superposition-supporting model of the cosmos anymore. All it needs to do is to perceive, to reflect, the cosmos that it's really in, as it really is.
The variations, the myriad possible alternative scenarios have been moved out of your brain,
Orlo said, rapping on his skull with his knuckles,
and out into the polycosm, which is where they all exist anyway.
He opened his hand and extended it to the sky, as if releasing a bird.
All you have to do is perceive them.
But each variant of me doesn't exist in perfect isolation from the others, I said, or else it wouldn't work.
Orlo nodded.
Quantum interference, the crosstalk among similar quantum states, knits the different versions of your brain together.
You're saying that my consciousness extends across multiple cosmi, I said.
That's a pretty wild statement.
I'm saying all things do, Orlo said. That comes with the polycosmic interpretation. The only thing exceptional about the brain is that it has found a way to use this.
Neither of us said a word as we picked our way down the path for the next quarter of an hour, and the sky receded to a deep violet.
I had the illusion that, as it got darker, it moved away from us, expanding like a bubble, rushing away from Arbor at a million light-years an hour, and as it whooshed past stars, we began to see them.